Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 98 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Co-hosting for the entire show this time is Dan Webb.
Yes, I know it's shocking for me to be back here, but finally done with school, so it's great to be here for the whole thing.
You're done with the semester, huh?
Yes. Still waiting for all my grades to be posted, but, you know, yeah, I've checked out mentally. Don't worry.
And how soon does the summer job start?
A week from today, I'm flying down to Washington, and then I'll be that week I'm starting my internship with the folks over at Flight Global, so I'm really excited about that.
That'd be great. It'd be a great experience.
Yeah. Me and John Ostrower in the same office. It'll be pretty geeky.
That is pretty scary. All right. Also co-hosting is our Airplane Geeks historian, David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hey, Dan.
Rob Mark is returning from some sort of boondoggle out of the country, but we've promoted past guest Phil Derner to the guest co-host spot.
Yay!
Yay! Thank you very much, guys. I'm really glad to be back, and I'm honored. Thank you very much.
That's good to have you back, Phil. Phil, of course, is from NYC Aviation.
If you guys didn't pay me, cut me that $1,000 check real quick. Wouldn't be here now.
Max, you cut him a $1,000 check. You're going to have some explaining to do, young man.
Yeah. It must be coming from Rob.
You guys are good people, and I'm definitely glad to be here. Thank you very much again.
Good to have you. Our actual guest this episode is George Hamlin. George is president of Hamlin Transportation Consulting. He's been in the commercial aviation and aerospace industry for almost 40 years, and he specializes in things like transport economics, marketing and strategic planning, aircraft requirements, fleet planning, economic analysis, forecasting, and probably a bunch of other things. And he's also worked at Airbus and Lockheed, TWA, and a number of other companies in the past. So welcome to the show, George.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Coming up, we've got this week's aviation news. We also have the Australia Desk Report, as usual, and David's This Week in Aviation. We'll finish off with a few listener emails. So why don't we get started right away with the week's aviation news. Our first story comes from Aviation Week. This is Boeing will opt for new narrow body. Now, this is a fascinating story, and I'm not sure if it's how sound the facts are. But what we have is an analyst from Morgan Stanley. This is Heidi Wood. And she says that Boeing is going to spend or may spend as much as $13 billion to develop a new narrow body jet instead of re-engineering their existing 737. According to her, the new aircraft could be ready for service in 2017 or 2018. So this is kind of fascinating. I mean, in the past, what we've heard is that Boeing and Airbus are considering re-engineering the 737 and A320 series aircraft. It's sort of maybe an interim step on the way to a brand new narrow body aircraft. And both the airframers have talked about announcing at some point this year whether or not they're going to proceed with that. So this is kind of a new twist. It's interesting. I'm not sure if Boeing is got the resources to develop a whole new narrow body. So George, do you think this is a likely scenario? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Whether or not it actually happens, we've got to remember they got pretty far with the Sonic Cruiser, although we had a significant event in September 2001 that did a lot to keep that from happening.
Right.
I think they've got the resources. I think there is probably something behind this smoke, some fire. Now, it's too soon to tell what's actually going to happen. I would not be amazed if it occurred. If they simply go ahead with re-engineering, that wouldn't amaze me either.
These sorts of things are interesting because, and we've talked about this before in the past, that Boeing and Airbus both have a strategy or maybe several different strategies for proceeding with this that may include some posturing, may include some, you know, holding cards close to the vest, and it's kind of difficult to tell what's really going to happen with this. It's interesting in the same article, Richard Abulafia, who's of course been on the on our show three times actually, from the Thiel Group, he's according to this article a bit skeptical of a all new replacement for the 737, and he's thinking that Boeing is actually going to or ultimately will look to re-engine. I think there's another story out there, too, concerning Airbus, which had previously said they would announce at the air show this summer at Farnborough what their plans were going to be for possibly re-engineering the A320. And now I've read that they've pushed out that decision to the end of the year so that they can consider, quote, other options.
No, there was an extensive article in Aviation Week about a week ago. I think it was last week's issue that discussed that. And I suspect they're probably closer to knowing more about these rumors about Boeing than we are.
Yeah, probably.
I suspect they're also quite concerned. It's interesting. I'm actually going to address some of this at a conference later on this week for a client. And it's going to be semi-public in the sense that it's a conference the client is putting on for its customers. So, you know, there's nothing terribly secret here. I've been taking a look at this. Boeing, of course, has done something fantastic with the 737. They've reinvented it twice, first with the classics, the 3 through 500.
Right.
Now the NG with the 6 through 9. This is pretty unprecedented in the business. Here's an airplane where the first delivery was in 68. It's still in production. Yes, Airbus has, you know, a noticeable, albeit modest, lead in terms of share recently. But the fact that an airplane that's essentially 20 years older than a competitor still competes tells you something.
Right.
One of the more interesting things that I found was the gap between first deliveries for the 1 in 200 and the 300 was about 17 years. The next increment was 13 years between first deliveries for the classics and first deliveries for the NGs. Airbus is now saying, one of their executives just quoted, is the new airplane, you know, the economics aren't going to be there until 2025. So that if you get an airplane in 16 or 17, 2025, it slips a year or two, Boeing knows how to turn a program to make some money in that time period. So it's certainly not out of the question.
I think George is absolutely correct. I think the 737 program, you know, over the decades is something that really should be applauded. But at what point does Boeing, you know, decide to really step it up in terms of innovation and say, you know what, there's a new body design or a new propulsion or something, you know, something's going to happen. I think if there's a re-engine program that's going to, you know, that they're going to go forth with, that would only have to be to delay whatever the next big thing is that's going to take us into the next several decades.
Right.
I think it would be a shame if something else, you know, if they did re-engine, that would mean that innovation in terms of body or propulsion or whatever other, you know, the new technology is another 10 years behind that. And I think that, you know, either side, Airbus or Boeing, someone is very soon going to be in the position to say, hey, guys, we found something amazing. This is what's going to come out. This is going to be what's going to take us in. And if it's not going to be Boeing, it's going to be Airbus. So I really hope that someone picks it up and does something.
Well, and if it's pure propulsion, it's available to both of them. In reality, an awful lot of the improved economics in the airline business beginning in 1970 with the wide bodies has come from advances in engines. Airframes have been improved, but not as radically as engines, both in terms of performance and fuel burn, as well as, you know, environmental considerations. There are also a number of strategic issues. Airbus is not, it would be difficult for them to come forth with an entirely new airplane now. First, the A320 entered service in 1988. Now, it's had a pretty good run thus far. They've probably, you know, gotten the economics of that program in good shape, but they'd like to keep on producing derivatives, you know, with a new engine and a modest development cost. That improves the economics of that program materially. Plus,
right, sure.
They're still trying to get A380s out the door, and I see we're going to discuss that in a news item, so I'll refrain from commenting more directly on that. And they've got to actually produce the A400M on the military side and get the 350 going.
Right, exactly.
They have a lot on their plate. Boeing looks like they've turned the corner on the 787. Just saw there's going to be possibly another delay on the 747-8, but that's a relatively modest program, and again, I think that's about to reach fruition. They're probably ready to do a new program. Airbus, from a public perspective, it doesn't look like that's exactly what they want to do at this point. So if Boeing is ready and can spring this on them, they're going to put Airbus in a difficult position because Airbus cannot simply not respond.
Yeah, George, I think you're right. Boeing appears to be in a better financial situation to develop something new, certainly more than Airbus.
I wonder how Bombardier plays into this with the C-Series. They've been getting some orders, but I wonder if, you know, Qatar has been saying that, okay, we're interested in this airplane. I'm sure both airframers are seeing if they'll see any orders at Farnborough this year for that airplane and probably figure out a better response at that point.
Airbus has been very vocal about the C-Series. Boeing has had less to say about it in public. Now, One thing none of us know is what's going to be the minimum size if Boeing does a replacement for the 737. And I think Heidi brought out Southwest has been pushing them to do this for years. What size is it going to be? Is it going to be 150 seats and up, or maybe 175, depending on the geometry of it? And I've heard Boeing is actually considering some fairly exotic things. Again, I think Heidi's report referred to the possibility of a twin aisle. It could be a relatively different airplane. But if it's fairly large, then Boeing is less concerned about the C-Series. If they want to duplicate the 737-700 size, then, yeah, that's head-to-head competition.
Well, I think actually Southwest could be, because, I mean, for years they've been married to 137 seats. Right. And obviously, I mean, a customer like that, I have to think they have a huge say in what this airplane will look like.
No, they certainly do. And, of course, they've launched two of the three series. Well, it was a co-launch with U.S. Air at the time on the Classic. They've launched two of the three variants. You know, and I think people tend to forget that. And it's funny because the industry reaction to when Boeing wanted to do the re-engineering that became the Classics that entered service in, I guess, 85, a lot of the industry sort of poo-pooed it. Well, you know, the 737, you know, wasn't doing, you know, hadn't done all that well in some respects. And, gee, here was, you know, U.S. Air was sort of the Rodney Dangerfield of the legacy airlines and the local service. And Southwest was not as extensive throughout the U.S. as it is now by a long shot. And of course, Southwest has turned out to be an outstanding customer.
I really agree with what you're saying there. And we'll get into that when we get into some of the later topics I know that we're going to discuss. But, you know, Boeing is not mentioning the C-Series much because, you know, to them the C stands for competition. And they're used to having a complete monopoly in this area. You know, yeah, Airbus is in Europe, but, you know, there's no real competition in the airliner market. There's nothing going on from Lockheed and McDonnell Douglas that are gone. You know, they have no competition. So when it comes to things like the tanker and everything like that, I mean, it's another player, and Boeing doesn't like it. And they're going to keep, you know, mum on it until there's a real reason for them to start talking about it. And, you know, it's time for another company to emerge and say, hi, I'd like to play in this game as well.
Well, and of course, we're seeing people like the Chinese, right, the Russians, the Japanese who'd like to play in this game also.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to see at least one of those entities survive, the most likely because of its large internal market and, you know, strong cooperation between the government, industry, and airlines is China.
Are they really going to emerge in the West? Are Western countries really going to buy Chinese aircraft, though?
It's too soon to tell, but you know, there were people in the 1950s and 60s who said that about Japanese cars also.
Yeah.
Good point. Wow, good point.
All right. Well, there are actually other people who are looking ahead into the future, trying to understand what might be happening, including NASA. And that takes us to our next story, which is from Red Orbit. This is Beauty of Future Airlines, More Than Skin Deep. And NASA is looking at certain objectives for aircraft in the sort of the 2030 era compared to aircraft that exist today. What they're looking for is aircraft that have a 71 decibel reduction below the current FAA noise standards, aircraft that have a 75% or greater reduction in nitrous oxide emissions, greater than 70% reduction in fuel burn. I mean, these are maybe far-fetched, but certainly laudable goals. So there's been some studies to try to decide or to try to identify what kinds of aircraft might meet these kinds of future goals. And the NASA has just completed this fundamental aeronautics program study, and with some kind of interesting results. There were a number of companies that participated in this. GE Aviation conceptualized a small aircraft, a 20-passenger aircraft with an oval-shaped fuselage that would use advanced turboprop engines. MIT came up with a 180-passenger configuration that they called a double bubble, sort of joining two aircraft bodies together lengthwise with turbofan jet engines at the tail. That theoretical aircraft features a lot of composite materials and ultra-high bypass engines. Northrop Grumman also submitted some ideas that included some ceramic composites, nanotechnology, and shape memory alloys, which sounds rather intriguing. And Boeing came up with a what they call the subsonic ultra green aircraft research, which if you take the letters, that's sugar, which is kind of... I'm not sure who thought of that, but okay, so sugar. The sugar is a twin-engine aircraft. It's got interesting... the proposal is for a hybrid propulsion system that is sort of a combination turbo-electric system. It's a twin-engine aircraft. It's kind of a standard tube-shaped body, but the wing is sort of a truss-braced wing. Interesting idea. So, I mean, I think it's kind of good that people are trying to look into the future, the far future, what seems like the far future, and you know, identify what are the concepts or what are the technologies that might... that might play a large role. So I don't know. Do you think is this a worthwhile exercise to try to, you know, polish up the crystal ball?
I think that I've seen some of those designs or similar ones before, like the whole blended wing body, right, which I've seen a couple times. And I mean, I look at it and working the way that I do with my airline experience, I think sure you can design all these different aircraft, but what's the market going to be in 50 years? You know, is the demand for these type of aircraft going to be there? Are the airports going to be willing to allow these type of aircraft to operate? You know, I look, great, what are you going to do with jetways in the future? Because these, you know, when the wing blends up into the body so much, where does the jetway go, or mm-hmm. air stairs? Or, yeah. And so I think about all this stuff, and some of them, it's fancy, it's nice. You know, of course the technology is going to advance with fuel efficiency, emissions, noise, that's a given. That's going to happen. So, you know, they're not quite blowing my skirt up yet, but I want to see how they're going to adapt. I want to see market predictions and how the aircraft are going to evolve around that. And these designs are nice. I don't think that what we're seeing is really going to apply.
Hey, Dan, I mean, Phil, when was the last time you went to an auto show? Why did the majority of people go to an auto show? To look at the concept cars. Why don't we?
You know,
I thought it was the models.
Did you call Phil me, by the way?
What's that?
Did you call Phil me?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I insulted Phil by doing that. I really apologize to Phil.
I'm no engineer, but I mean, I'm looking at the renderings and I don't think they're that cool. I mean, maybe they like threw some flames on them or something, but you know, that's pretty much all I could say.
So you're unimpressed, huh?
No, I'm just kidding. I thought they look cool. I mean, I don't have enough experience.
They need some rims.
Yeah, but
seriously, I mean, the best ideas come from somebody playing with ideas. I mean,
yeah, I agree.
We don't ever have someone rolling out a new aircraft, unless their name is Bert Rutan, that looks completely off the wall. I mean, you see these drawings, but you never actually see one in person. I mean, it's about time that maybe these companies start doing what they used to do. Build something, fly it, and if it doesn't work, you scrap it. But at least you built it. I mean, computer models are wonderful, but we got to get to some old school just... You know, sometimes you just got to put it together and see if it flies. Maybe I'm old-fashioned thinking that way, but...
You're not at all, and I agree. But like I said, the blended wing body impressed me 10 years ago when I saw it in Popular Mechanics.
Well,
you know,
blended wing was something, when I was at Lockheed, I was in charge of a new business development group. This was Lockheed Georgia, where the Herc, the C-5, the 141 have been built. But we were allowed to look at a number of things speculatively, and we actually took a look at some blended wing bodies, and there were a lot of interesting things about them. Now, one of the passenger interface things people talk about is if you make the airplane fairly big, it begins to look like a theater or an auditorium.
Right, yes.
You got to be careful how you bank this airplane, because think about it. If you're sitting on the far left or the far right, yeah, and all of a sudden you go, you know, past a few inches of bank, this could be unnerving. Especially in a large room that's probably going to be without windows, or at least very few people are going to have access to the windows. Mm. So it's been kicking around a long time, and you know, it wasn't novel then. I had a friend who worked at Lockheed who actually held some patents on an earlier version of this that dated back to the 1960s. Now, at that point, pre-computer flight controls, it simply would have been unstable and not likely to work. But some of the basic principles have been around for a long time. And then, you know, remember the so-called flying wings of the 1950s.
Sure.
They worked. We now have one.
Yeah, we do.
And it's the exact same wingspan as the original flying wing bomber, the YB-47.
Right.
The B-2 is the same wingspan. So there's something to be said for old ideas coming back and being recycled, because sometimes they're new again.
No, and it would be nice to see something truly innovative, except this has become a very risk-averse industry on both the airline operating side and the manufacturing side. And unless the numbers look like they're going to pan out, it's very tough to go to a corporate board these days and say, we want to roll the dice. We want to bet the company. Now, of course, Boeing has bet the company several times and basically won. But there's probably not as much stomach for this at the moment. And if you think about where we are coming out of this recession and people still talking about whether it's going to be a double, i.e. double, you know, a double dip, it's probably a little soon yet.
You know, there's some other interesting concepts that have been floated to try to achieve some of these same kinds of ends, that being reductions in emissions and increases in, or rather decreases in fuel consumption. And about a month or so ago, I attended a session by a professor, Ramesh Agarwal. He's from the from Washington University in St. Louis. And he's done some studies to try to see how these technologies could be employed to achieve these goals. He delivers a speech called Sustainable Aviation Challenges and Opportunities. And he talks about some of these things too, new aircraft designs, new engine designs, alternative fuels. We haven't talked about that just now, but we have in the past, composite materials, other materials changes. But he also talks about some really interesting additional concepts. I almost said off the wall because they are kind of unusual, including air-to-air refueling for commercial planes as a way to extend the range without with a positive impact on fuel burn per passenger. He talks about close formation flying. This is like, when you see geese flying in a V, he actually thinks about what if you have commercial aircraft that are, at least for some portion of their flight, are, along the same lines, and what kind of fuel economies could you, enjoy by flying them in a formation the way geese do?
The flying train.
Yeah. It's interesting stuff, and I guess the way I look at it is I'm glad that there are people thinking, creatively, looking into the future, trying to achieve the the goals that where we'd like to see aviation go.
Jetpacks. It's all about my jetpack.
Okay, so enough on that. Probably let's move on to our next story, which comes from BBC, and maybe we can just mention this for just a minute. This actually came in from a listener. This is from BBC News: non-crew and cockpit in Polish president's plane crash. And you've probably seen in the news that after examining the cockpit recorders, that the plane that was carrying the Polish president that crashed, it appears that there were other non-flight crew personnel in the cockpit at the time. And I think we've seen this in some other situations in the past. We had a Russian pilot that had his kids in the cockpit with him. I mean, you'd like to think that pilots were focused on the job at hand, as it were. Should be allowed to operate the aircraft without influence from outside forces, which is maybe what happened in this case.
When I read the article, I wasn't quite sure. At first, it was like, was someone present in the cockpit, or was someone trying to influence them? And if there's just somebody present, sitting in a jump seat, observing, having a good time, I honestly wish that the world environment was that more people could get to enjoy that. And see what goes on in the cockpit during takeoff and landing, even during sterile cockpit time. As long as they're being quiet, man, that it's such an amazing experience, and I've been so lucky to have that myself. But many times, and I wish I could give that to other people, that experience. And as long as they're keeping their mouth shut, the debate I think really comes when these people are actually influencing them, and the politicians saying you better land at this airport. That's where the concern comes.
Right.
Yeah, I've had the experience also outside the U.S. of flying in cockpits, and a professional crew will brief you, particularly during landing and takeoff. You're not going to talk, and both parties understand how it's going to work. And there's a fair amount of flight at cruise that the pilots certainly talk amongst themselves, but they're not hands-on flying the airplane at that point either.
Right.
That's right. And they'll teach you about the, if you need to put the oxygen mask on and stuff like that. Even as an employee, I've legally rode in the jump seat. And you know, they'll teach you, hey, you know, do you know how to work the radio? Do you know how to work the oxygen mask just to play it safe? And that's fine, you know, but when these guys start talking about, you know, hey, were they, you know, telling these guys, hey, you better land at this airport. I don't care what it is. I mean, to me, that's like walking a president through a crowd of potential terrorists. I mean, that's a serious security concern. And it's, you know, the minimums are in place for a reason. And it's shocking and sad if that is, if that was a factor in this tragic crash.
Well, this is a smaller scale version of if the chief executive wants to run military small unit tactics, but much less overall grand strategy, the results may not be that good.
Okay, why don't we talk a little bit about labor relations? Now, I know we got in a little bit of trouble Dan got in a little bit of trouble in the past for trying to be an expert in this field. So even though we're not, let's give it another shot. We see from the this is the Providence Examiner. The AirTran pilots have voted to authorize their union to call a strike, and this is if federal mediation for the new contract through the National Mediation Board or the NMB, if that fails. And apparently, it was a pretty resounding vote. And this is not a vote for a strike. This is a vote by the union members to authorize their union to call a strike. It's not the actual strike, but the vote was resoundingly one-sided. According to this article, 95.7% of the AirTran pilots voted in favor of authorizing a strike.
That's not unusual in the run-up to this, because you need to show management that you have some solidarity, and you know there's this relationship here that you're willing to do this. This is not the actual strike, but if only 56% vote to potentially authorize the strike when it becomes time, then management is not going to negotiate very hard with you.
Right, exactly. And the article also mentions that these contract talks have been going on since 2005. So we've got almost 5 years worth of discussions without forward progress.
How does that happen? How do contract talks go on for 5 years with no resolution? No strikes, no this, no that. Don't these people wake up one morning and go, haven't we done this long enough? I mean, I don't understand.
The industry's been through some pretty tough times. You know, you had high fuel back in 2008, followed by the global recession. When the talks got started, it might have been reasonable to expect that things to have been concluded by then. But, you know, in 2008, when times were tough, you didn't hear as much saber rattling about let's go out and strike. People were worried about getting laid off and having a job, or maybe the company fails.
I think things have, the environment has completely changed. And if I were around couple decades ago, I'd really love unions. But I think, like I said, the environment has completely changed. And, you know, you say, you know, why are negotiations going on for 5 years? It's because the unions want their union dues, and they want to drag it out for their own interests. And I feel like I'm going to get in so much trouble for saying that. But it's like the people need a union for their union. I honestly think that, and it's such a shame. And this AirTran, specifically the AirTran, really bothers me, because I think that AirTran is in an amazing position, especially with Milwaukee. Milwaukee, specifically, that city, so upset that Frontier was chosen over Midwest. AirTran, as a company, is trying so hard to get that market. This is their time. They're trying to strike while the iron is hot. They have, like, they have the Milwaukee Brewers scheme aircraft, which, just because of the colors, looks a lot like a Midwest aircraft. They're trying so hard to get in that market. They want to do their thing. And then the pilots are like, hey, guys, let's strike. And I think that's horrible, because they're only going to interfere with the chance for success. And if something happens down the road and AirTran doesn't succeed, the union's going to be the same people that are complaining, hey, why are we being furloughed? Hey, guess what? Your strike kind of put us into trouble over there. That's what I see.
Just from the management side, I mean – other, except for, I think 2008 was the only year where this happened in recent terms. But generally, labor is the biggest chunk of an airline's cost. So obviously, this is a huge issue, especially when AirTran, I mean, they've always been bragging about how on a stage length adjusted basis, they have some of the lowest costs in the industry. They're always competing on cost. So this is a big issue on both sides.
Now, there's a lot of other labor activity going on. We also see that the American Airlines flight attendants have also voted to authorize their union to call a strike. over issues, according to Business Week, issues of compensation and retiree benefits. And then we've also seen in the past week in the UK, the British Airways flight attendants have been allowed by a court that overturned an injunction that was previously blocking them from striking. But apparently the court has ruled that they could. Are we seeing all this stuff going on now? Is it just, is there some overall trend here, or just sort of it just worked out that we have these kinds of things all going on at the same time?
It is a trend.
Some of this goes all the way back to deregulation. It was more than a feeling that airline costs, particularly labor, had gotten higher than they would have been under market conditions. And in fact, labor costs have come down considerably since deregulation, and particularly since in this last decade, when the airlines, both in the U.S. and worldwide, have lost lots and lots of money. Labor would like to get that back and take it, ultimately back, possibly even to where it was, in the happy days of regulation. That far, I don't think is going to happen. But their point of view is, all right, we helped you get through the downturn. Now we've got to get something back. And management is saying, well, wait a minute. We're still not making, some of us aren't making money yet. That if we do that, people like Southwest, AirTran, Spirit et al. Are going to eat our lunch and take your jobs.
Well, and the other issue for American, where you're saying, when labor unions say, okay, well, now that we're recovering, in the case of American, it's something that American management loves to remind everybody of, is they didn't go through bankruptcy like everyone else, so they didn't get to adjust those labor costs.
And they still have defined benefit pension plans. They haven't fried them like virtually everyone else. One of the more fascinating things to me in the economic history of this business is if you go back to the start of deregulation in the U.S., there were 11 trunk carriers, including Pan Am, and there were 8 local service carriers. Exactly one of them, and you've just named it, is A, still here, and B, has never been in bankruptcy.
Hmm.
Now, this also makes you wonder why people invest in airline equity.
Yeah, you've got to ask that question, yeah.
I think the honest ones will tell you they trade in it. They don't invest in it. Everyone says, as a trader, I'm going to get out before the next bankruptcy.
And by the way, George, as you mentioned Spirit, actually, just to add to the pile, those pilots are getting ready to strike too. So,
correct.
I think just to add to the pile. Sorry?
No, striking has definitely become a trend. And, just like we're looking for some kind of new technology for aircraft design, we need some sort of new innovation for labor relations, because this whole striking thing is getting completely out of hand. In certain industries, if you're working at a factory and you strike and your bosses are the only people that are truly relying on you, I can understand. But, when pilots strike, there are so many people that are working for your airline that, also risk losing their job. You're not going to gain any fans there. The passengers that want to fly, the businesses that rely on getting around. At certain times, I find it to be a little irresponsible. On the flip side, when companies are yanking your pensions, if I work for a company for 2 decades and they say, sorry, we're yanking your pension, I'm going to be displeased. And I'm putting that very lightly for you guys. I would be more than upset someone taking money out of my pocket. And I would meet it the same way as a mugger reaching into my wallet. That's no good. But I just think the striking thing, it's getting old, and I'm so tired. I'm just tired of that.
In fairness to labor, if there's never going to be a strike, then the negotiations, you're negotiating from a point of toothlessness.
Mm-hmm.
That if you don't strike on occasion, then nobody believes that that you won't cave.
Right. It's the big stick, but if you don't wield it from time to time, it doesn't have an impact.
Yeah, and the speak softly, everybody ignores that.
That's right.
Well, I call for union reform, Phil Derner 2012.
Yeah.
Well, I think politically, I think things have changed as well, because I remember reading about a couple of weeks ago that President Bush basically said that, I really won't allow the National Mediation Board to allow a strike, an airline strike, while I'm in the White House. Well, now we have a new administration that I think some view as more pro-labor. So, but from an airline leader perspective, one thing I really enjoyed reading is Willie Walsh over at BA. And this was before – the court judgment was reversed back in United's favor. But he had an opinion piece in the Times over in London. Headline, I won't let these militants stop BA from flying. And I just found it so interesting, because a lot of – over on this side of the pond, you're seeing airline leadership be very quiet. Okay, well, everything will be in the negotiating room. Seeing Willie Walsh come out so publicly against the union is just kind of funny to watch.
Okay, why don't we move on and talk about Lufthansa. And we see Lufthansa has taken the delivery of their first A380. Lufthansa has 15 of these on order. And this is, according to this article, the 28th A380 that has been delivered to a customer. So it's a small number.
Put that in historical perspective, and it's an amazingly small number.
Yes, yes.
747, trivia question. What was the maximum number of deliveries of 747s in 1 year? In which year was it?
Oh, gee.
The maximum? 172.
No, it wasn't quite that good.
No, no. I would say maybe 40.
No, it was 92.
Oh, really? Wow.
Wow.
Now, what year?
I'm still sticking with my 72.
you're pretty close. It was the first full year of deliveries, 1970.
Wow. That's an amazing ramp up. That's an amazing ramp up.
Yeah, there were four delivered late in 69. The program, if you remember, if you looked at the history, was delayed by problems with the JT90 engine. The airframes were sitting out there with concrete blocks hanging off the wings, you know, to balance them, waiting for the engine.
Yeah, I remember that.
It's not a Boeing problem. So that only four were actually delivered in 1969, and then 92 in what was in effect the first year of deliveries. Never been equaled.
That's amazing. Well, at this rate, it's going to take Airbus quite a number of years to break even. I don't know what the break-even number is for this aircraft.
Well, disclaimer, I've worked on a team that did a study of the A380 program's economics for Boeing, and our conclusion was that it lost multi-billion dollars. There's no break-even.
Yeah.
Now, I recognize I'm coming with, I guess, what some would call prejudice. It is my opinion, and it's backed up by numbers. But I don't think it's going to be a profitable program ever.
Yeah. I mean, that's a tough one. You've got to, I mean, the development costs of something like this are just, I mean, so enormous that you've got to reach a certain volume just to cover the development costs.
Well, and the economics of an aircraft program are heavily weighted towards what happens in the first years. It's the economic concept of the time value of money. Don't expect to break even in the first 3 or 4 or 5 years.
No, absolutely not.
You push that out further and further, well, all the money you borrowed to do the development is only accumulating interest.
Right.
If you slip in the early years of a program, it's usually disastrous from a financial perspective.
Yeah, it makes sense. George. And you know, as we mentioned, I mean, Airbus has the whole A350 and the other programs that we mentioned, the 400M hanging over its head too. So that's a lot of investment dollars tied up.
An enormous amount.
And if they were developing an aircraft that was maybe one third of the size, designed for a market that might actually be in demand, you know, maybe they can spit out twice the number, three times the number per year, and they wouldn't be in such difficult financial times.
So to date, I think there are 202 on order. And again, if you compare this with the 747, which the initial orders for the 747 were in 1966. We're talking more, you know, 44 years ago.
Gosh, it's hard to believe.
The industry was a fraction of its size.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Okay, on that basis, it's even more impressive. All right, let's switch over to a little bit of military aviation news.
David, are you going to cheer?
I was going to say, this is where I was supposed to go, yay!
That's right. All right, we've avoided talking about the tanker for a week or two, but Boeing just wouldn't let it alone, and they had to introduce something new, possibly new, into the mix. And this comes from Defense News. Boeing is mulling all options on tanker. It's worded in kind of an interesting fashion. The article says Boeing's officials this week declined to rule out abstaining from the U.S. Air Force's KCX tanker competition. Now, here's a quote from Boeing's Bill Barksdale. He's a tanker spokesman. He says, "We're deeply concerned about the ability of a heavily and illegally subsidized Airbus/EADS to accept levels of financial risk that we cannot in a way that distorts the competition. Given that fact, and until all final RFP amendments are in, it's only prudent not to completely discard our options." So what we have here is Boeing saying, hey, you know, hey, we might not bid. Yikes.
Yikes. I was just about to say the same word.
Have we ever heard someone saying they won't bid before? I'm trying to think.
Which week is it?
Yeah.
I, being the resident tanker expert on the subject.
Not willingly, but just by
not
default.
Not willingly, yes, by default. both companies need to quit their whining and start bidding. This, in my humble opinion, was the ultimate in whining. They were very happy when there was no counter bid and encouraging there to be a counter bid. Now that there's a counter bid, they're whining. And Boeing needs to just shut up and make the better product and put an airframe on the on. I mean, this is one of those things that we go back to our build, just like build the aircraft. At this point, the Pentagon needs to have just a good old fashioned fly off, like you did with the F-16s and the F-17s. You put them two on the runway, you give them the same bit of duties, and the one that does the best job is the one you buy. Let Boeing build a tanker, Eads build a tanker, and let's just fly them and see who does the best job and then build the thing.
I think hasn't the problem been with this whole tanker debacle is figuring out what we exactly want the tanker to be good at in terms of the size.
I don't think
between the 7.6 and the 8.3.
I think the answer is we want it to pass gas to the guys who are able to drop the bombs and do their job. I mean, that's what it's supposed to do. How it gets it done, who cares? It should be able to carry the guys to the front lines, and it should be able to fuel the aircraft so that they can all be there to drop bombs on the bad guys. That's what a tanker does. This is... And Boeing's has been doing it a lot longer than everybody else. So they're just whining, and I think I'm done proselytizing on this.
I don't want to say anything that you guys have said in past broadcasts or go over too much. But my biggest problem, you know, this problem should not exist. And it goes back to what I was saying before about competition. When was the last time, and, you know, I could be wrong, maybe it has happened. Have we ever bought a fighter jet that was made in another country?
Besides the B-57, the Canberra, besides the PC-9, which became the T-6A Texan II, we have bought European products. They were the best products for the job at the time.
Well, I don't think it should be that way, and it's not Boeing's fault. It's not maybe you could say it's Boeing's fault for buying every other aircraft manufacturer in the country, but there's no competition here. And there should be. It's exactly what I'm saying before. You know, we don't see Lockheed. These guys are not on the scene. There's no McDonnell Douglas. There's no one there that's out there in the game. Someone needs to be in the game. Airbus should not even be a thought in this. And this should be a domestic issue. And the same thing for Europe. Europe should look within their own for their own aircraft, for their military. I just personally think it should not be that way. They're talking about the cost. They're talking about performance. Patriotism should play a large role in this. And I think it's a great shame that we're considering Airbus. If we go with them, if they're the right aircraft for the job, I have no one to blame but for lack of competition because of what I see as a Boeing monopoly here in the United States. And as much as I love Boeing, I think we'd be a little stronger if we had a second player.
Well, here we see Boeing playing the WTO card, right? And I think we knew it was coming.
Mm-hmm.
George, do you think that's going to ultimately have an impact on the decision here?
It's been in a political sense. And I've steered away from the tanker because I have not looked into the requirements. Therefore, it's really tough for me to be able to say, all right, one airplane is better than the other, because I understand airline fleet planning requirements, at least in many cases. And this one, it's not clear to me what's needed, so I've tended to steer away from which airplane. Now, the trade issue, yes, the WTO has issued its finding. Now, it's not public yet. That's not coming out for another few months.
Right.
Then we're also going to see the WTO will rule on the European complaint about the U.S., but they have clearly said that Europe has got to do something different from what they've done in the past. Now, of course, at the moment, the Europeans are proceeding with financing the HB-50 in the same way that they've done the others. Now, you're probably familiar with the argument that's made by the Europeans is, well, there are two kinds of subsidy. One is direct, where a government actually pays money to get an aircraft program going, and maybe it's repaid with loans, maybe it's not. That's direct. Indirect is things like NASA and the European and comparable agencies in Europe. Well, the Europeans look at the U.S. and say, all right, we have our direct, but you have your indirect.
Yeah.
Well, the reality, NASA's aeronautical budget is not exactly huge. I mean, we're citing these interesting gee whiz studies, but that's pretty small potatoes compared to what the overall money being spent is.
Sure, right.
In reality, what's going on is Europe has direct subsidies. The U.S. does not. Europe has large and growing indirect aid to its manufacturers. A lot of it is actually focused on Airbus products specifically, whereas NASA, you don't see a NASA study on the 787 directly, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I've done some work for Boeing as a client on looking into some aspects of this. And the U.S. and Europe signed an agreement, I think it was in 1992. It was the right answer to the wrong question. It was how much, and it limited subsidies on direct to basically about a third of development costs. Whereas the question should have been, are we either going to have direct subsidies on both sides and indirect on both sides or not? It was a case, I think, where the U.S. got out and negotiated. But we got to wait and see what the WTO says formally and then get the European reaction to it. I don't think they're going to like it.
Again, our guest this episode is George Hamlin. He's president of Hamlin Transportation Consulting. George, can you tell me about fleet planning? What is it and what are the keys to fleet planning?
Well, it's a supply-demand exercise that you basically got to start with what's the demand. On the military side, for example, what drives a program is what's the threat. But if you don't see future traffic out there, there's no need to plan for a fleet in the future. Now, doing that long term can be a pretty daunting task. I actually wrote my master's thesis on the subject of fleet planning, although when I think about how different it was when I did that, I mean, the basic principles are still the same, but a lot of the nuances are quite different and there's a lot more sophistication in it now. You've got to take a look at what the economics of the business are going to be like. So you need to know what are the potential revenues. I mean, you know, business in some respects is fairly simple. You have revenues, you have costs, and hopefully the difference between the two of them is a positive number. With revenues being higher than costs. In the airline business, that's a suspicious statement and not always true, but that's at least the aim. Now, you've got to estimate things like what are the competitive demands. You're familiar with the issue. Boeing and Airbus argue a lot about what's called fragmentation. In other words, if you go back 50 years ago, virtually all transatlantic traffic flowed in and out of New York, out of Idlewild or JFK, depending on when exactly you're looking at it. You know, we've had gateways as small in this country as Nashville going to London. Now, some of the fragmentation has actually retreated a little bit, but we're not going back to where JFK and Boston and, you know, maybe a little bit of service out of Chicago and one or two flights from the West Coast, and that's it on the Atlantic. You know, you've got hubs like Atlanta and Houston and Dallas that have extensive transatlantic service. Cincinnati had, I think, six or eight flights a night before it was cut back after the Northwest acquisition. There are a whole bunch of variables. It's essentially what you're trying to do is figure out what does my future schedule need to look like? And that involves forecasting the traffic growth, the revenue growth, trying to figure out what the competitive dynamics are, and then adjusting for things like new trends like market fragmentation, where I guess a lot of people would tell you that basically started in 1970 when National began flying Miami-London, a very non-traditional route on the Atlantic, and it was principally an origin destination route because, you know, National did not have what you would consider in today's terms a hub in Miami, and Miami geographically was tough to do that in anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The economics of costing the aircraft, of course, this gets to be a variation of almost liar's poker. When I was at Texas International doing fleet planning, for example, we were looking at larger aircraft than the DC-9, which was the backbone of our fleet. And at one point, we were talking with McDonnell Douglas about the DC-980, what became the MD-80.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were two manufacturers competing for our business, and they had very different views of the performance of the aircraft. One told us that we wanted to know about its performance out of Mexico City, hot and high field. You know, Mexico City, Houston was a fairly important route. If it wasn't going to do that, it could have caused some problems. One manufacturer told us that the airplane would carry a full load not only to Houston, but probably to New Orleans most days if needed. We weren't going to do that because that wasn't a hub, but you know, it gave you a nice feeling of comfort that if you could take a full payload to New Orleans most days, then Houston was going to be a problem virtually not at all. The other manufacturer's view of the same airplane said that you wouldn't get a full load on it out of Mexico City beyond the Rio Grande. And we really weren't looking at the MD-80 for serving Mexico City, McAllen at that point. You've got to resolve some of these claims. And, of course, trying to get a handle on the cost, there are things like guarantees. Now, actually, usually a contracts department is the one negotiating guarantees. But it's a tough thing. It's a tough thing to tie down. And of course, then, well, it used to be that within a fairly small period of time, the manufacturers actually delivered the airplanes when they said. Mm. What do you do if you plan and, you know, for you to start using the new airplane at a time? And you probably put some cushion in there, but then 18 months later, it's not available. That's, of course, you know, we've seen that recently.
Well, it sounds like there's a huge number of variables involved in this sort of thing. And, you know, each with their own probabilities of occurring where you expect them to and not. In the end, how accurate is this kind of planning? I mean, is it marginally accurate, or is it highly accurate?
It more often than not is pretty good. I mean, I'm trying to think of, you know, some things that have gone wrong. I mean, some aircraft types haven't worked out so well, for example. Mm. There were people buying Convair 880s and 990s at one point back in the 50s for service in the 60s, and that airplane simply didn't do what it was supposed to. Mm. The MD-11 is an example. American Airlines bought it with, I've forgotten the specific range guarantee, but it was going to go from Dallas, I think, to Hong Kong with a full load, and it simply could not meet that performance aspect, and then American developed quite a jaundiced view of the airplane, and of course now has a fleet of 777s. Mm. Boeing is in charge of McDonnell Douglas, among other things. You have to understand the flight costing side of the business, and I was very fortunate when I began working at TWA that I really wanted to be in scheduling and planning. The job that was available was in the finance department, but I got to know the flight costing system quite well, and the concepts of it are something I still use today. And a lot of the data for that is actually for U.S. carriers. You can go into what's called Form 41, was the Civil Aeronautics Board, now USDOT. It's www.bts.gov is the location of it on the web. And you can begin to educate yourself. There's a lot of material there. You may not want to do it as a leisure time pastime. I was going to say timetable reading is more fun, but we can't find those anymore either.
You know, George, I'm wondering what you say about, you know, from a sales perspective, you know, they say, oh, this aircraft can reach New Orleans from Mexico City in those conditions. And I think that's so interesting when, you know, people, you hear what an aircraft can do in terms of, like I said before, fuel efficiency and emissions and noise and stuff like that. And then you start getting into what the specific airlines need themselves. And you hear, oh, you know, it can go there. And you mentioned a couple examples where the aircraft fall short of that. And that's expected. I think any airline that's going to be buying a new aircraft, you know, they don't have the experience to know 100% for sure. And often, you know, maybe a salesman may, you know, add a little buffer to that to try to make it more appealing. Do you know of any situations where an aircraft maybe has overperformed, or actually, you know, hey, wow, this aircraft did even better than we thought?
I'm trying to think. Sometimes aircraft come out in development, usually at some point in their development, they're overweight. But some of them have come out actually with better performance than anticipated. Not startlingly better, but they beat the calculations. And given the experience and the tools that they have now to analyze this, both, you know, computing and computational tools, the predictions have gotten better and better. It's a fairly mature business. Now, in point of fact, Continental, the successor to TI, operated the MD-80 between Mexico City and Houston, and the two of them pretty much averaged out. They would do a full load most of the time from Mexico City to Houston, and it was fine. Hmm. Now, one thing I never understood in working with one of the manufacturers that I know well on a personal basis, there's something called brochure or marketing specifications or rules. And then there's something called airline rules. You don't want to know about the brochure or the marketing rules. They don't mean anything. I mean, this is under the most optimal conditions. Now, airlines typically in a fleet planning process or campaign will specify, for example, American was known for years to have very, very conservative rules on fuel reserves. And that has a huge impact on long-haul international performance. That's the way American behaves. And, you know, American also is known as a quality operator. Whereas a new entrant carrier, if it didn't have people who were experienced, might not know to do that. Hmm. And might look at the manufacturers. I ran into a new entrant, and I can say that this new entrant failed in fairly short order. That was looking at doing a short-haul market in the Midwest that was about 300 miles, and they were going to use 737s at this point. And by the way, this was a market that competed with Southwest, and they showed me what they thought their cost structure was going to be. And I looked at it, and I couldn't believe it. Southwest couldn't achieve that kind of cost structure on a 300-mile segment. Well, I got them to tell me how they computed the number. What they'd done is to take the average 737 cost, but that was for, and they'd gotten the data from the manufacturer, that was for, I think it was an 800 or a 700 or a 1,000-mile segment. Well, the cost is much lower. And if you do what's called stage length adjustment, in other words, how the airplane would be operated on a 300-mile segment, their cost wasn't any better than Southwest. This carrier did, in fact, fail.
That's fascinating.
No, and of course, then you've also got, you know, this huge competition between Boeing and Airbus now.
Yeah.
And as we alluded to earlier, it's probably only going to get worse in terms of with Bombardier with the C-Series being in there. You know, this is going to be a regular demolition derby.
Is residual value, I'm thinking of the A320 and 737, if they're to be re-engined, is the residual value issue as big as some people make it out to be?
Residual value is an issue in financing. If you look at the practice of the U.S. and what I would call the legacy carriers in Europe, they tend to use aircraft over their economic life. And, well, if you're Southwest and you basically buy them and pay cash for most of them, residual value, it's a nice thing. Now, but it's neither here nor there. You're going to buy it. You're going to depreciate it. You're going to make money with it over the course of time. And then when it wears out, it's sort of like your favorite old car that you kept for a long time because you liked it, and you kept it in good repair and it worked well, and you go do something new.
Right.
Now, if you're the financier and you're loaning money on it, or you're leasing the airplane, or you own the airplane and you're leasing it to an airline, you care a whole lot about what the residual value is because you might be underwater at the end of the time period.
Yeah.
Now, for a long time, beginning in 1973, 74, we had a fairly long period of inflation in the economy and in the airline business. You didn't have to be a genius because the prices of everything, including old airplanes, was being pulled up. Put this in context, the original 747s cost about $20 million apiece. You can't get a narrow body for that today.
Yeah, right.
But when you had double-digit inflation, fine, the new airplane might have been $40 million, and the airplane that was 5 years old, which, you know, for the sake of argument, was bought for $20, well, it still might have been worth $20 to $25 million on the books. And was a good, you know, with that, that represented a fair spread between it and a new $40 million airplane. But depreciation, no, the thing was appreciating, at least in an accounting sense. Now, in terms of buying power, that was not true. But accounting typically doesn't measure buying power without adjusting for it.
Okay, George, I know we don't want to take too much of your time, but if you've got a minute, we've got one little thing that we do that I didn't tell you about. We play a little game with our guests that we call Word Association.
Okay.
And all we do is say a word or a phrase, and then you just start talking about whatever comes to mind. So it's kind of a way just to start a conversation.
All right, let's do it.
All right, so do we have a volunteer to go first? Or?
Ooh, for the once, I will go first.
Ooh, how unusual. Dan strikes. Go for it.
I know. Well, actually, but before first, George, just because you mentioned it earlier, is it sad that on occasion I have gone into Form 41 for fun?
You have gone into Form 41 for fun?
Yes.
All right, and I'm supposed to do word association here.
It was just a yes or no question. Is it sad?
It is, yes, Dan, it is sad. It's very sad.
Okay.
You obviously want to be a consultant.
Well, you might have something there.
Well, actually, my dad's a consultant. I think he has the poster that, like, consulting. If you're not part of the solution, there's great money in prolonging the problem. But anyway, my word association, since you were at Texas International, so my word association for you is a name, Frank Lorenzo.
He was CEO when I was at Texas International. He had a nickname in the office, El Jefe.
Ah.
Frank, as you may know, is of Spanish heritage. Yes, he was the boss also.
Do you look back fondly on those days, George?
It was very interesting. We worked very hard. We got a lot done, and there were some really interesting things going on. He was actually a more nuanced person than given credit for, you know, particularly as things went much further. I do remember I'd come down there from TWA working in New York. TWA management and labor, they got along in the sense that the company worked, but certainly were not big friends. I'd been at TI about 2 weeks, and we had, I guess it was the monthly management club meeting, which I went to. TI's principal ground employees union at that time was called the Airline Employees Association, no longer exists, and was replaced eventually by the Teamsters Local in, I think, Dallas. Anyway, at this time, the ALAA still, and when Lorenzo's management team had taken TI over back in the early 70s, about 2 years into their tenure, there was a bitter strike over issues, sounds familiar today, part-time, split shifts, you know, all economic efficiency issues. And it was pretty nasty, and there were a lot of hard feelings for years. But by 1978, my jaw almost dropped when the big event that night was the head of the union presented Frank with a cowboy hat as a token of the union's esteem. It was quite different than what I was used to in labor managed relationships at TWA.
Yeah, yeah.
I give you just another brief picture. Frank Lorenzo in an apron, barbecuing food at an employee picnic.
Oh, fantastic. I love it when the boss rolls up his sleeves and gets involved like that.
Don Burr did the same.
Hmm.
I have one for George, actually.
Go ahead, Phil.
You know, knowing George's photography and seeing some amazing stuff from over the years, I'd love to get some thoughts in response to my saying Pan Am Terminal parking lot.
Oh, a moment of silence and sadness that it can no longer be accessed. What a place. No, observation decks at one time in the 50s and 60s were prevalent. What was the old International Arrivals Building at TWA. I'm sorry, at JFK, Idlewild, had a marvelous one. All but the center portion of it was closed by the early 70s, and I think somewhere in the early 70s that went too. But the Pan Am Terminal, particularly in the afternoon from photographic lighting perspective, offered much of the same. And it was just a neat place to go. Many happy hours up there.
I often feel like I was born in the wrong decade. I just want to say to everyone, you know, George offers some amazing insight and knowledge, and it's so entertaining to listen to him. But people who have not seen some of his photography really need to look into it. It's just great, and you get to sit there and stare at these shots forever. And you folks really need to have a look at some of his work.
You have some of that on your webpage, right?
I do. And the webpage has got links to my photos on both jetphotos.net and airliners.net.
Right. And people can find your webpage. It's georgehamlin.com, right?
Correct.
Yes.
Now, I'm in the process of working on a 40-year retrospective. I took my first airline slide in 1969. And those of you in the D.C. area, the Washington Airline Society meets at the Air and Space Museum downtown the last Wednesday in each month, and you can find their website also. I'm going to give the presentation on 40 years of airline photography and some oral history. It's scheduled for the September meeting this year. That means I've got to finish doing the presentation soon.
Did you say 1969?
Yes.
It must have been Kodachrome, right?
Virtually. I switched to Fuji Provia in 2000, and the last couple of years I've been completely digital.
Right.
Yes, everything else was Kodachrome, and thank goodness because of the longevity of Kodachrome.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, George, I've got a word for you, just really quickly. It's my word is deregulation.
Lightning rod. it's been a pretty big factor. Now, fortunately, I was in the industry, I guess, 6 or 8 years before it came into place, but then most of my career it's been there. I have no desire to go back to a regulated business. This is a business. It needs to be run like one. Yes, that can be ugly at sometimes. Now, of course, the biggest problem is under regulation, carriers basically didn't fail. You merged them into somebody else using what was called the failing business doctrine.
Yeah, right.
Well, we found out a couple years into deregulation with the demise of Braniff that carriers could actually fail. But the analogy is, remember a few years back when they had the big forest fires in Yellowstone Park, and we learned that that's actually part of the regeneration process of the ecosystem, is you do have to get rid of the deadwood.
Mm-hmm.
I think there they found there were some seeds, pods only actually burst in the heat of a fire. Apparently this is a natural process that, you know, people have been limiting for years. Deregulation, yes, familiar names like Pan Am disappeared. I mean, in effect, TWA disappeared as well. But again, I have no desire to go back to a regulated business.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, me too. Good. David, do you have a word for George?
Braniff.
Well, I think I mentioned, I'm not sure who was on the call, I do some work with Airways Magazine, and they're in the process of getting together. It should be out in the next month, I think either in late June or sometime in July, a special issue. We've done them before on TWA, Southwest, Alaska, on Braniff. And of course, this actually builds on an article that was in Airliners magazine back in the John Wegg days in the early 70s. Only it will be considerably expanded. But now Braniff was color is the word association you got to have with Braniff.
Hmm.
You know, an incredible piece of marketing. Unfortunately, its business acumen wasn't quite as good in the end. Although it's little remembered now. We talked about deregulation. At the time of deregulation, there was exactly one carrier that had an investment grade rating on its bonds, and that was Braniff. Braniff made a great living in the 70s not doing wide bodies, for example.
Yeah, right.
And then they made a great mistake at the time of deregulation. Their CEO decided that all this expansion was going to be, in effect, a limited test. The government wouldn't like it and would rescind it. So that you had to grab everything you possibly could, you know, in the opening moments of it. It was sort of a Big Bang type proposition. So they did. And, of course, to use all these dormant routes, you actually had to fly them. They were doing things like Atlanta-Tucson in the middle of the night just so that they could claim them. And then they went into a lot of international markets, you know, using their SPs, and they acquired some full-size 7-4s as well beyond the Big Pumpkin. It simply didn't work. But it was great while it lasted.
Yeah. All right. Well, George, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. We'd love to hear your insights and benefit from your experience.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and it's been fun, and you know, I've enjoyed it.
All right, George. Thanks again.
All right. Take care, guys.
Take care, George. Bye-bye. Really a pleasure.
Thank you, George.
Bye. Thank you, George.
Phil Derner, again, thank you for joining us. Really a pleasure to have you back on the show.
No problem. Thank you, guys. Really, I'm really glad to be here and be a part of this.
So anything interesting going on over at nycaviation.com?
Actually, you know, we're working on so many things. We've had an amazing year. The past 12 months have been huge for us, and we don't really plan on stopping. We're actually, by the end of the week, we should be an official corporation. And we're going to be implementing a whole bunch of new features, revamping almost every single feature that we currently have to make it that much better. And, you know, constantly serve, you know, aviation enthusiasm as we've been trying to do. I don't want to, you know, I can't really share too much, you know, some of it's a little secret, but we're going to be coming out with a new online store. Everyone's going to be able to buy the old NYC Aviation t-shirts that are going to be redesigned, and a whole bunch of other new designs. We've teamed up with a couple other websites, going to be selling some things, and our forums are going to be completely revamped, and a whole bunch of other new features, which, like I said, you know, we've gotten an amazing response from so many people, and folks helping us promote it like you guys have been such a big help, and we want to keep serving everyone, and we want to win Best Enthusiast Site of 2010 as well from Flight Global.
Yeah.
So not going to stop.
One of the things that's always struck me is that your site and a couple of others, I think, really raise the bar in terms of what an aviation enthusiast site can be like. I mean, there's certainly a lot of aviation sites out there, and even a lot of them that are pretty good. But NYC Aviation is just, I think, one of the kind of rises to the top in a lot of ways. So we really appreciate the work that you guys have been doing.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And plus, I mean, you guys got drudged a couple weeks ago. I mean, how awesome is that?
Yeah, that was really cool. We've gotten some notoriety from, you know, some attention from a couple different places. But, you know, being on Drudge, not that I'm a Drudge fan, but being, you know, having our article linked there right at the top of Drudge Report, one of the top 100 websites on the internet is, man, that was a fun day. I called Matt, my editor, and I was like, "Yo, let's go out for drinks."
I bet.
I thought that was great, and that was really cool. And like I said, it's a wave that we want to ride, and you know, we want to wait for the next wave and keep going and going, and keep, you know, coming out with things so that enthusiasts out there have resources and can have fun. There's so many challenges that I think that we face as airplane geeks. So, guys like you guys and what we want to do, we want to knock down those walls and make it fun for everyone.
Fantastic. All right, Phil, thanks. Thanks again.
Guys, thanks again.
All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, and now with This Week in Aviation, it's David Vanderhoof.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation History, Volume 2, Episode 15, May 23rd through the 29th. May 24th, 1976, the Concorde begins operations in the United States. Two Concordes, one in British Airways livery, the other in Air France livery, simultaneously touched down at Dulles International Airport. The two aircraft were flew over the capital with special permission from the Secretary of Transportation, William Coleman. This was after Coleman had approved two flights a day to JFK and one each to Dulles for a trial period of 16 months. May 26, 1961, a United States Air Force B-58 Hustler, 592451, the Firefly, was flown to the 1961 Paris Air Show. The crew was Major William Payne, Captains William Pohemus, and Raymond Wagner. The crew would pilot the B-58 at a blistering 1,089 miles per hour. The New York to Paris was flown in 3 hours, 19 minutes, and 58 seconds. The flight originally began in Carswell Air Force Base in Texas and lasted a little over 6 hours to fly the 5,150 statute miles. May 26, 1972, Cessna rolls out its 100,000th single-engine airplane off its assembly line.
Wow.
If anyone knows what that was, could you please let me know? I could find it. They did it. They just didn't say what it was. So it was a 150, a 172. It was probably a 172. But if there's somebody out there who knows that, could you please let me know? On May 26, 1977, the world is introduced to the Force X-Wings. And I've got a bad feeling about this as Star Wars debuts. Any airplane?
Actually, random facts. Today is the TV premiere of the Family Guy parody of The Empire Strike Back. For those I want to watch it. It's hilarious.
Great. I hope it's as good as the first one. May 27th, 1931, the National Committee on Aeronautics introduces the first full-size wind tunnel at Langley Field in Virginia. May 28th, 1977, a modified Lockheed 1935 L-10E Electra lands at Oakland, California. The flight, piloted by Linda Finch, successfully recreated the flight that Amelia Earhart was lost upon. The flight lasted 73 days, beginning on March 17th. Linda had restored the 10E after spending $330,000 on the aircraft initially. She flew in 12-hour increments and had a Grumman Albatross chase plane. She also had five different navigators fly with her on the world crossing. Lastly, Captain Charles Blair makes the first single-engine solo flight over the North Pole using a P-51D Mustang on May 29, 1951. The flight was from Bardufoss, Norway to Fairbanks, Alaska. The Mustang, Excalibur III, flew the 3,375 miles in 10 hours and 29 minutes. Our first flights that occurred on the week of May 23rd through the 29th. May 23rd, 1904, the first flight of the Wright Flyer II. May 26, 1942, the Northrop P-61 Black Widow. On May 26, 1952, the Cessna 180 Skywagon. On May 27, 1958, the McDonnell's F4H1 or F4A Phantom II. On May 29, 1935, the Messerschmitt BF-109. And lastly, on May 29, 1937, the Grumman G-21 Goose. And that's the way it was May 23rd through the 29th.
Thank you, David. That B-58, that was the first supersonic bomber, the first U.S. supersonic bomber, right?
That's correct. Mach 2 bomber. It was actually capable of 2 times the speed of sound.
That was 4 engines, kind of a delta wing plane, right?
Delta wing podded 4 J-57 engines. Carried a center pod for fuel and nuclear weapons. Crew of 3, 1 pilot, 1 navigator, 1 weapon systems operator.
Now, for you folks listening, that was not a planted question. David answered all that off the top of his head.
When it's one of your dad's favorite airplanes, you learn these things.
Is that right? Okay.
The best restored one, folks, is if you ever get out to the U.S. Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio.
In Dayton, yes.
It's a beautiful, sexy, gleaming silver, looks fast on the ground aircraft.
That's an amazing museum. That's a must-visit destination if you're at all interested in aviation.
It's a shrine to military aviation.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, May 23rd, 2010.
Well, g'day, folks. Welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 98 of the Airplane Geek Show. Steve Fisher back with you once again, and just barely staying awake over there on the other side of the Skype link. Grant, are you there? Hello, Grant. Wake up.
Oh, hey, sorry, man.
Another
sorry,
can of Red Bull into you, mate.
Oh, mate, I'm freebasing my Red Bulls today. It's been a very long week. I've been crewing balloons all week, and we've had some beautiful weather here, and had the balloons up every morning and been doing playing crazy and IT work all afternoon, so every day. So I'm pretty drained, man. Fortunately, the weather's changed and socked in, so I'm not flying tomorrow, so I can get a good sleep in and wake up at 7 and feel refreshed.
It's truth. Waking up at 7, what, a.m.?
Yeah, I will have slept in for 3 or 4 hours longer than normal.
Tell you what, boy, that sounds disturbingly early to me, mate. Well, before you fall asleep completely, let's go into some really weird news.
Oh, what?
Let's take a journey beyond financial sight and sound. Yes, that's right. Our good friends at Tiger Airways. I'll get that sound effect right one day. Are reporting, Grant, that they've made a profit. Can you believe it?
A profit? Tiger? Oh, my no! God. I'm in shock. This is amazing. How do you feel, mate?
Oh, really?
That's how I feel.
Yeah, that'll pretty much do it. This is Tiger Airways reporting over in Singapore where they're based. The whole Tiger Airways operation has reported a profit. They've actually managed to turn around and report a pretty good year so far to the Singaporean Stock Exchange. The problem here is that you can't really separate. They don't separate out the Australian operation and show it. They don't show the details for the Australian operation in clear text. So you have to assume that maybe they're breaking even, maybe not. But according to Tiger Airways President and Group CEO Tony Davis, Australia has been breaking even primarily for the last 3 of 4 quarters of the last financial year. So, yeah, things could be turning around a little for Tiger. They've got a way to go, of course, but nice to see they're making some money.
Yeah, of course, some people have expressed surprise at this. And to be honest with you, Grant, I'm not surprised at this at all. We were talking before we started recording here about this, and it doesn't surprise me at all. They're obviously full because, as we've discussed many times before, their fares are so low that everybody has their price, and they don't seem to be having any trouble filling passengers that perhaps haven't had the Tiger experience before, and perhaps some that even for whatever reason actually enjoy it. So, I'm not surprised that they're making. Their fleet has swollen now to a whole 9 aircraft.
Oh, my God. It's amazing what some people will pay for. I mean, there's clubs for that. But, there's people who will race to the bottom, and despite whatever goes on that annoys them, they're ready and willing to pay for it. If you don't mind the potential of being stranded somewhere and you can live with a nickel and diming, Tiger's not too bad for you.
I'll tell you what, Grant, with a 29% increase in their profit this year, do you reckon that means they could leave their call center open beyond 7:30 at night, Australian Eastern Standard Time?
Tricky.
Hey, maybe they could get through and answer that complaint that I left for them back in November 2008.
Very tricky.
Not very bloody likely either.
No, it's sort of up there with those thing, that list of recreational impossibilities, getting Tiger Airways to respond to Steve's complaint.
Well, good luck to Tiger Airways, and hopefully they will continue to lift their game and actually become a decent customer service based airline. We can only live in hope. Moving on, Grant, to our next story here, and we're going to have a bit of a dig at our politicians here, perhaps something I love to do. In fact, I reckon I could do that for a sport, Grant.
Oh, mate, look, having a dig at politicians is sort of like shooting fish in a barrel with an elephant gun and no water. It's easy.
Well, it seems that Australia's Transport Minister, Anthony Albanese, is not making any friends with the pilots' unions at the moment. He's looking to strengthen regulations governing cockpit entry rules for aircraft that are in flight. And now, at the moment, apparently it's a self-regulated system where the cabin door is locked shut, as it is in most passenger aircraft around the world in other countries. He's looking to make that actually a law. And to be honest with you, Grant, I didn't know it was a self-regulated thing until I read this article in Australian Aviation this month.
The way it currently is that there are restrictions on who's allowed in it, but it's up to the airline to actually manage and control that. They set their own policies that only certain people are allowed on board, but that means that they can put non-revving pilots on the flight deck. If they've got to get someone quickly from point A to point B, they can stick them on the jump seat. This is going to go out the window. You're going to wind up with a situation that unless they're doing check-in monitoring or safety monitoring work, then they will not be allowed on, which means that for a urgent transport of pilots or non-revving pilots, they're going to have to bump a paying passenger or delay the pilots to get where they have to go. So realistically, I call complete Bravo Sierra on this one. I think the transport minister's got his head firmly where the sun doesn't shine. He's out there trying to pander to the population. We're coming up on an election. The current government is not in the world's best position at the moment. With an election around the corner, they're trying to make out that, ooh, we're doing things for safety, when really this step could actually reduce safety by reducing the number of eyes monitoring what's going on in the flight deck.
As the cynic in me would say that this is to shift the public's attention away from other issues. But one of the other things they're saying that they're proposing to do here, which has raised the ire of the Australian and International Pilots Association, is they're shifting a responsibility for flight deck security to individual pilots. And their president, Barry Jackson, is saying that shifting criminal responsibility to the pilot in command undermines a long-held aviation principle that the airline is ultimately responsible for the actions of its pilots. That's really interesting, too. You know, I often wonder, Grant, whether such situations should be judged on a case-by-case basis rather than having a blanket regulation that says, you know, that the pilot in command is ultimately responsible for, you know, any given situation, or the airline, in fact, is responsible for this sort of stuff. Personally, I think it would make more sense to just look at, you know, if something were to happen, and it ended up in front of a court, then, you know, you would let the court decide ultimately who was responsible for whatever situation had happened.
I just see this one degenerating into a really nasty situation. Technically, the pilot, the captain of the flight, is the final say and authority in what goes on. But I'm seeing it in businesses and politicians all around the country and the planet are using safety and security as an excuse to ramrod policies through. Albanese is trying to score some runs and he's saying, hey, safety, security, we're going to make it safer for the people. Well, no, they're not. And they're just looking for things to do. And as you said, Steve, it's distraction time. Once again, they're going to try and wave some hands and make it look like they're doing things when they're just really making it worse.
The various pilot unions here concerned have taken themselves off to Canberra during the last week, and they've gone off to lobby as many politicians as they can to block this. It actually didn't make it through the Senate the last time this bill came up, and the way things are going at the moment, I would say it probably won't make it through the current Senate either.
So we can only hope.
Yeah, so we'll just leave that one there, and just a couple of quick ones before we finish up. I think we've got a major case here of... Yes, that's right. If you remember back to episode 30 of Plane Crazy Down Under, for those of you that are good enough to listen to our little show, we talked to Dan Colborne, who flies the only A319 registered in Australia at the moment, down to Antarctica, and does all the transport flights between the Australian mainland. Well, of course, in the off-season, that aircraft is redeployed for other purposes, and at the moment, it appears that it's ferrying asylum seekers backwards and forwards across the Pacific. Well, Grant, they had a bit of a mishap recently.
That's right. This A319 in particular has built-in air stairs at the rear doors. That's so that it can land on the blue ice runway down in Antarctica and not require any ground service equipment. Of course, that's a bit of a problem if you forget to retract the stairs and all your indicators on the cockpit are saying that the stairs have been retracted. Unfortunately, they began their taxi and were heading out to the runway. Onboard cabin crew heard all the noise, looked out the window, saw that the stairs were still there, and madly called the flight deck to get them to cancel and stop moving and retract the stairs.
Yeah, lucky they realised before they got too much further down the runway, or we might not be talking about this in such jocular terms, Grant.
No, indeed. And the Australian Transport Safety Bureau are going to be doing an investigation into the incident, but they do say it's probably going to be short and factual, as they consider this to be a pretty low-scale incident compared to others.
Yeah, okay. And just before we finish up, folks, just a quick update on our good friend Owen Zupp, who was on the show last week. And the latest blog entry says, I've now been there and back, and it feels fantastic. So big round of applause for our friend Owen. And, yeah, well done, mate. He's finished that flight. That's a lot of hours. It'll be interesting to see, be very interesting to see just how many flight hours he did rack up in that Jabiru, all told.
Total elapsed time and total number of hours in the air, that'd be great things to see. But unfortunately, I don't know if it was us who jinxed him, but not long after Melbourne, he started to experience some weather delays and issues, and some parts of his route did actually get cut and had to be dropped due to problems with the weather. wasn't quite as perfect as required, but he did manage to make the majority of the sites he wanted and was back to Bundaberg, his starting point, on time, and in fact came in with a formation of other Jabiru aircraft around him.
Yeah, of course, it's not too late, folks. If you'd like to jump onto thereandback.com.au and make a donation, I think he's just about up to $10,000 raised for the Royal Flying Doctor Service.
He's actually just cleared $9,000.
So there you go. So let's get that up over $10,000. Let's make it our Airplane Geeks listeners who push that up over the edge. Of course, just remember, of course, what is one US dollar buy at the moment?
About $1.10 to $1.20 Australian.
Oh, it's a bargain, folks. It's a bargain. So let's help push Owen over the $10,000 mark. And the Royal Flying Doctor Service are really really worthy cause. And poor old Owen, of course, as he mentioned a couple of interviews back, he is a Qantas pilot. He flies 737s for Qantas. And he's going straight back to work and straight into the sim for a murderous sim session, as he put it last weekend. So poor old Owen, not much rest for him, unfortunately. All right, Grant, well, you're sounding pretty weary there, mate. It looks like you're just about to hit the sack.
Yeah, mate, I'm totally channeling my inner Rob Mark and feeling like I'm pretty drowsy and...
Well, folks, at least I'll be back with you next week for episode 99, and we're certainly creeping up on 100. I'm Steve Vischer.
Oh, sorry, mate. Yeah, I'm Grant McCarran. See you all.
All right, I'd like to thank Steve and Grant. You know, those guys often stay up really late into the night to try to put together the Australia Desk report for us. And it's not just a cut-down version of their own podcast. It's a separate recording that they make. And I know for a fact those guys were dead tired when they did this one. And they did a great job. So I want to thank them, as always, for their contribution to this podcast.
Yeah, thank you, guys. And actually, random fact that you might find interesting is Skytrax this past week, I think named... Garuda and Indonesia as most improved airline, which would I think go along with his trip report from the couple weeks ago.
Yeah, Garuda could certainly use that. All right, on to some listener mail. All right, we had a note from 15-year-old student pilot Matthew. He wrote, "Dear Airplane Geeks, I'm a young student pilot and was wondering if you could focus a little bit more on GA and less on airliners. No offense to airline crew." So, yeah, we actually have been trying to increase the content of general aviation stories. And Rob is actually out, or Rob is supposed to be actually out, hunting down some more good GA guests. So we'll look for that. We had another email also from Matthew, and I assume it's the same Matthew. Well, yes, it would have to be, unless there's two Matthews writing us who are both 15-year-old student pilots. He says, "Dear Airplane Geeks, in reference to your last episode, which was 97, when you said that less young people were interested, well, me personally, I would save work for a month just to fly for 30 minutes. Would not mind getting in $100,000 in debt."
Okay, Matthew, you're 15 years old. Trust us, from us older people, you don't want to do that. Enjoy your flying, but don't get into the debt.
That is the hard part.
Yeah, passion is appreciated, but the finance major in me, well, might say, depending on your situation, yes, assuming debt could lower your weighted average cost of capital, but on a personal side, just don't do it.
Well, here's how Matthew closes. He says, "It is for the love and the thrill of flying. I don't care about the pay. It is worth it. Flying is the best thing in the world." So there's your passion. Follow your passion, Matthew. You're going to be great.
And get some good student loans or grant.
Finally, we got an email from Errol C. He writes, "Hi, team. I've been listening since I came across the Cranky Flyer." And he pointed to episode 83. "I also trade insults with the PCDU Aussies." All right, Errol.
Okay, you welcome. Thank you.
Errol says, "Hate to complain about David's pronunciation. Uh-oh. But the Dambusters are 617 Squadron, not a funny-sounding American 617, even though the Brits made the BAC 111. Would have loved to have been at Edwards, maybe someday when your laws are friendlier to tourists. Keep up the good work."
You meant Andrews, and okay, it's 617 Squadron. I sit corrected.
Are you not going to do that Concorde email?
Oh, I got it. We also just recently got an email from Tony. He says, "Soapbox time. Reference Air India Express crash in Mangalore." He says, "Now is the time to ground all B-737s. There was one Concorde crash since its first flight in 1969, caused by bits falling off an American or Continental DC-10. This killed the Concorde. How many B-737s have gone Tango uniform? Ground them. And that's from Tony.
So actually, I did look into the numbers a little bit, and this is from airdisaster.com. Unfortunately, these are numbers through the end of 2004, so a few years out of date, but I haven't found anything better. But there's a good chart. So through the end of 2004, there are actually 47 events involving the with at least one fatality events involving 737s. But over that time period, there are 76 million 737 flights compared to 0.08 million. Concorde flight. So the accident rate is a lot higher for the Concorde, but remember, it's only one. But I think a few other things were going on with the Concorde as well. You had the crash, which of course was a big deal. But then when you had that a poor economic environment with 9/11, that really affected air travel. And also, it was kind of expensive to operate. I mean, if you think about it, I think when they were through from service, Concorde was, if not the last, one of the very last passenger aircraft out there that still had on transatlantic routes three pilots up front. And when you have such a very small cabin, it was expensive to run. And from what I've heard, and apparently from I read this morning, that Eads and Airbus weren't too keen on supporting them much longer. Though actually, a funny story is Richard Branson tried to make a play for the Concorde fleet, saying that Virgin Atlantic could make a go of it, and British Airways wasn't very happy.
Yeah, I remember that. That would have been interesting
to
see.
They did not make the deal. Well, at first Branson, as kind of a joke, I think he offered like £1 for each Concorde.
Yeah, I think
because of the government assistance involved.
Yeah, some money had to change hands.
I think he was offering about like £5 million per aircraft, but eventually, it didn't work out, and BA quickly and Air France quickly sent them to museums. But at least the Concorde flight numbers now live on with the new British Airways London City service between London City Airport and JFK with those fancy new A318s.
Yeah, and I don't know what the accident rate for the 737 is compared to other airlines, and you'd have to measure it the right way, like you say, on a accidents or incidents per million miles traveled, or per cycle, takeoff and landing, or something like that. You need some denominator that would be appropriate, but it would be interesting to see how the different airframes stack up against one another in that regard.
Well, the good thing is, for most of the commercial aircraft out there, they're very low.
Yes, good thing. All right, well, I think that's it for this episode. Again, we'd like to thank our guest, George Hamlin, for joining us. You can find his website at georgehamlin.com. That's George, GEORGEHAMLIN.com. And as we mentioned, he's got some good aviation photography there that you can see, as well as learn more about the services of the consulting firm that he operates.
Yeah, no, he was great. I learned a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, George is great. So we'd like to thank Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron again from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk report. And also to Phil Derner from NYC Aviation for joining us.
We love you, Phil. You're so awesome.
All right, Dan Webb, where can people find you online?
You can find me online. First, if you want to find me online, get your head checked, because you should have been annoyed enough after an hour and a half. But if you're still sane, or insane enough rather, you can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage, or you can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
If you're really bored and you've had enough of Dan, you can find me at DM Vanderhoof on Twitter, or you can find me at my blog, which is whatjustflewby.com.
You guys seem like you have self-image problems, I tell you. No. So listen to this. I'm Max Flight, and you can find me at my fantastic website, 30,000feet.com. And when you're done looking at that, find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. See, how's that? You like that one better or no?
I thought it's fine.
I thought it was overcompensation, but...
Yeah. All right. You can send us email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Airplane Geeks. Be sure to check out our Facebook page. And you can also see us at our webpage. That's airplanegeeks.com. We also have a listener line.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
We haven't gotten very many voicemail messages recently, so we'd love to hear from you guys. Everyone listening, consider leaving a short message, even if just to say hello, or to tell us what you like about the podcast, or tell us where we're mispronunciating words.
Feel free to call me an idiot.
Anything you like. It's wide open.
If you are attractive sounding and from the West Coast, you're sure to get on.
Why the West Coast?
Well, doesn't anything like Long, if someone says they're from Long Beach, doesn't that always sound better than if they're from the East Coast?
Yeah.
Yeah, like oh, I don't know. Like, if they're from, like, you know, Boston, New York, I'm like, okay, whatever. But if they're from, like, a place like Philly, I'm like,
just doesn't have the same impact, huh?
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. That was supposed to be a shot at David that apparently crashed and burned. On the flip side of things, also, I'd like to point out we do have 8 more fans than the Australians. So thank you, listeners.
It's that close, really?
Yeah, but for a while, they had more fans than us.
Oh, we're catching it. We've passed them.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
No competition here. All right, thanks for listening. Join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Max, first, just
yeah,
to quote Pam Ann, the comedian, you got to say Lufthansa with some finesse. Like, Lufthansa! Like, a nice little right. We will be on time!
Okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind, Dan. It's David Vanderhoof.
Thanks, Max.
Yay! David, woo! Aviation history!
Now, where did this happen again?
Cocoa Islands.
Cocoa Islands, okay. Who would be the investigating authority there?
CASA. Cocoa Islands are ours.
Oh, of course. I knew that. Is that a blooper?
What time is it?
It's not even midnight yet. Big round of... Woohoo! Might just try that again. I pressed the wrong button.